Hello, I'm Jill Novak, and this is David Bella, and we're going to be talking about computer as metaphor, part two. And I'm responding, basically, to what Dave presented last time on computer as metaphor, and applying it to ethics, because I think often in ethics we have a notion of thinking as a computer, and ethics is one of my special concerns. Now, in order, I'm going to summarize a little bit of what Dave said, and he's going to correct me if I'm wrong, because I didn't check with him ahead of time. And
that's the nice thing about these joint sessions. They're such surprises.
That's right. And and I figured that if I misunderstood him, then there might have been other people that misunderstood him also. So I won't even be feeling guilty if I did. Now, Dave was talking about a computer and the way a computer worked, and implied that much of our thinking really models after a computer, or sort of mimics a computer. And he says, I am modeling myself after a computer if I demand precise, ambiguous instructions.
Unambiguous,
right. That's what I have written down, see?
Okay.
Precise, unambiguous. Yes, it is, that's written down.
Computer would take care of you right away on
that. precise, unambiguous instructions which are completely consistent. And I am immobilized by inconsistency, and I am faithful to the instructions in the sense that I will always follow them no matter what, if they are consistent.
That's the way a computer behaves.
That's right. And I would be modeling myself after a computer if I think that way. Mm-hmm. Right? Okay, one more time. Precise, unambiguous instructions, which are completely consistent, so that I'm really thrown or immobilized by inconsistency. And I will be faithful, in the sense of computer faithfulness, to the degree that I will always follow the instructions, no matter what will result. And the example he gave, I thought, was really very good. It was a form of looking at the Bible as a computer printout, and some people that want to look at the Bible as a totally comprehensive set of instructions programmed by God, the great computer programmer in the sky. And we must follow these instructions in all situations, following the if something, go to the precise rule. Ethicists tend to talk about that as a Bible, as a rule book written by God. All I have to do is find the right rule, and I'm faithful to it if I follow it no matter what. Now, there are a lot of problems with this other than it works like a computer. For one thing, the historical situation is ignored. Let's take an issue that some people are concerned about, masturbation. Well, so happens the Bible doesn't talk about masturbation, but that's all right. It has to be comprehensive, right? The great computer programmer in the sky wouldn't have left out something, so I can find something that relates to it, which might be the Onan story in Genesis 36, 6 to 10, where Onan is criticized for withdrawing from sexual intercourse before ejaculation. Now, if I look at the Bible that way, I don't have to take into account the historical situation. In this case, I wouldn't take into account the fact that that the Bible is very concerned with wasting of seed, of sperm. And it seems to believe that everything that's necessary for the baby is already found in the sperm. And the woman is just a fertile field in which the sperm is planted. Therefore, this kind of activity could be almost seen as an abortion. Life is being lost. But for some people, then, to say that would be error. You know, the Bible couldn't commit an error. It couldn't not understand that the sperm only has half the genetic material. Therefore, we have to throw it away, or else somehow I'll follow the law anyway, despite the reasoning of it. Now, another example might be something like slavery, where the Bible appears to have contradictory information if I look at it as a law book. Paul said, in Christ there is neither Greek nor Gentile, slave nor free person, male nor female. But I can find other parts of the Bible, right, that accept slavery. Okay, now if I'm looking at it as a computer programming, one, I can say, oops, it's inconsistent, therefore I can't act, therefore error. Therefore, I reject the whole Bible. The other way would be to accept one set of laws and ignore the others. Now, the people that were very good at doing that were the people that used the Bible to favor slavery in the 18th and 19th century. They harmonized. What they did was they said, the Bible clearly accepts slavery. It also criticizes it. So when it criticizes this, it must be consistent. It must mean that there is neither slave nor free man before God in heaven. Therefore, I harmonize the whole Bible. I have a nice computer program, and I foster slavery. Now, there are a lot of suggestions that would be wrong with that approach. One is that the historical situation is completely ignored. The computer programming is ahistorical, right? It has to apply to everybody. The second one that Dave mentioned and John talked a lot about last night is that we're just using the Bible to plug into our regular mindset, to give us answers to what to do without really changing our lives. We're not allowing the Bible to address our think with, our basic assumptions. And the basic assumptions relating to something like slavery is that we have a right to exploit others. We have a right to think that we are better than others. We have a right to dominate others. That's what slavery means, doesn't it? Once we look at it as that, we can see there's a lot in the Bible that moves away from that. Causes towards shalom, the interrelatedness, the harmony of all people with other people and with all of nature. That seems to cry against this kind of exploitation. Or the whole movement in Jesus' ministry, where Jesus shows special love for those whom the world despises, those who are weak, those who suffer the most. And if we allow the Bible to address us, these themes can come through, modify our think with, so that we can reject slavery despite the passages that might support it. I'll give an example of that. Sarah Grimke. Any of you have ever heard of Sarah Grimke? 19th century woman who was raised in a southern plantation. She's a daughter of the plantation owner. She tries very hard to fit into the slave culture, you know, be the southern belle, the lady. She's in high school. She goes to all the parties. She wants to be a lawyer, but she can't be a lawyer because she's a woman. But she's bugged by Galatians 3, you know, in Christ there is no male, female. And she allows it to address her, and she takes a stand against slavery, goes north, works with the Quakers, becomes declared illegal to go back to South Carolina because of the stance she has taken. Her whole life, her whole way of approaching becomes transformed, in contrast to saying, I'm going to keep my life and plug in at the law book. Now, that's a computer programming, I think, in Scripture. But we do that in other than Scripture, don't we? I think the best example I know of a faithfulness in terms of a computer one is some people's definition of patriotism. How does a computer does exactly what it is told? And that's faithfulness. How about faithfulness to country? I do exactly what my country tells me to do. Any of you remember the phrase that was around in the 60s and 70s? My country, right or wrong, tell my country. Always obey your country no matter what. Yeah, love it or leave it. America, love it or leave it. Notice how that is very much the faithfulness that we're talking about in terms of computer. That a computer could understand.
We also had one, Earth, love it or leave it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that.
Now, in this way, I'm agreeing with Dave, but I'm going to disagree with him now.
Okay.
And he said that he seems to think, he assumed that we don't want to be computers. I'm going to question that. I'm going to argue just for the fun of it, that most of us really much of our time want to be computers. We would say we don't want to be, but we want to be. Computers demand precise and unambiguous instructions. And then Dave went on and made a difference between deciding, which a computer can do, which as I understand it would be a detached, objective, figuring out which instructions apply to which case, and choosing, which he defined as having the capacity for empathy, for caring, for compassion. Is that correct? Do you think our society really trusts the emotional part of us? As I was a kid, and I'm a woman, and women aren't supposed to be conditioned as much as men on this, I was told to be rational, to be objective, to not let my emotions get into my way. In fact, haven't any of you ever been embarrassed by your emotions? I'm sorry I got so emotional. Forgive me, I got carried away. Even emotions of compassion, love, and caring. I cried at the funeral. I'm sorry. I was joking with one of the people that was up last time, one of the our pastors, and he said he couldn't stand to see this movie without crying. I said, "We got to be a man and not cry." And he said, "It's okay, because I get my eyes wiped by the time the lights come on." He was joking. But that whole notion, right? What are we trained? My whole in theology. A PhD in theology, not in engineering, but in theology. I was trained to think with my mind and to detach all my emotions. Be rational, be objective. And somebody, when we were talking about it, said, oh, the only difference in the computers is only in the emotions. Well, whether the person meant only or not is hard to tell. But I think often we might mean that. Only emotions. And I think his response was, especially emotions. Because that's what makes us different. And yet, much in our society is really telling us to look out for that. And because emotions get in the way of hard thinking. Emotions get in the way of being objective. Emotions mess us up. Become a computer. Now, I see that in a lot of ethics, and not just the kind of ethics that would use the Bible as a law book. In fact, I'd like to use an example of it in, have you ever heard of Joseph Fletcher's The New Morality, Situation Ethics? Anybody hear of that? Okay, it was around, very big at one time. Joseph Fletcher's still very big in bioethics. And he says our problem is that we see the Bible as a rule book, and he's against that. That's too computerized. People want a law and they can't have it. So he says what we ought to do is follow Christ by working for the greatest love for the greatest number. There's only one norm, love. And that's what we ought to work for. The greatest love for the greatest number. Now, he has to, though, on talking about love, he's very clear that it's unemotional. Because he wants to distinguish agape love, which is the Christian norm, from phileos love, which is a friendship, and eros love, three words for Greek love in the New Testament, which is a love for someone who is especially attractive to me. The reason he wants to do this is he wants us to love all people equally. Now, if I feel, and I have to calculate how to love all people equally, and if I have a special attraction toward one person, it gets my calculations messed up. Now, in case you don't believe me, let me just read a little bit from his book, Situation Ethics. Notice how he's moving toward the ideal of love being a head thing, a calculating, the greatest love for the greatest number. In fact, at one place, he'll talk about what we need is agape calculus, how to calculate using calculus to give the greatest love to the greatest number and get it evenly distributed so I don't give too much to one person and not to the other. Christian love is not desiring. Agape is giving love, non-reciprocal, neighbor-regarding, neighbor meaning everybody, even an enemy. It is usually distinguished from friendship love, or philia, and romantic love, eros, both of which are selective and exclusive. I'm friends to some people, lovers to some people, but not to everybody. Erotic and philic love have their proper place, but they are not what is meant by Christian love. Erotic and philia love are emotional, but the effective principle of Christian love is will, disposition. Christian love is an attitude, says Fletcher, not a feeling. It's an attitude that works for my neighbor's welfare. gives to all people just what they deserve. For that reason, it has to be distinguished from liking. Christ's love was not an inner feeling, a full heart. Agape love is not primarily an emotion or an affection. It is primarily a determination of the will. That is why it can be commanded, whereas feelings like liking cannot. Those for whom true love is an emotion will take hate to be its opposite rather than indifference. Agape love is volitional, willful. It is cognitive. It is not based on emotions of sympathy or affection, because then I'm being involved in it and I'm not being objective. And when I get involved, it's really self-love. Okay, so the task of the Christian then, says Fletcher, is to calculate how to get the greatest love for the greatest number. And that means I have to be very prudent, right? And calculating to figure out everything. And this is what Fletcher says about prudence. Prudence and love are not just partners. Prudence and love are one and the same thing. Let me read you another illustration of this. I'll start here. Prudence and love are not just partners. They are the one and the same thing. That is to say, Christian love and Christian prudence are one and the same, since they both go out to others. This is a side of love that businessmen can appreciate, as when a production engineer tries to balance product quality against price in a low-income market, or a personnel manager has to choose between letting an illness, a weakened supply clerk keep his job on one hand, and on the other, playing fair with line workers whose output and price rate pay are being cut down by the clerk's delay. Love is as prudent as a field commander who has to decide whether a platoon or company or even a regiment is expendable, and if so, which one. Prudence, careful calculation, gives love its carefulness it needs. With proper care, love does not just take justice into account, love becomes justice. Love, evenly distributed, the ideal is justice. Now you see what he's doing? He's making his ethics into a kind of thing a computer can do, right? What? Yeah, trying to get everything that we can put prices on things and calculate the greatest good for the greatest number, the greatest love for the greatest number. And we can't let emotions get in our way. And in fact, according to him, at one time, at least if we could take the account literally, Jesus goofed. Can anybody think of when Jesus goofed? He gets his standard from Jesus. You know, what did Jesus, all of his ethics come from Jesus, right? All of Jesus' ethics can be summarized as love. Can anybody think of one time when Jesus goofed, according to Fletcher? Well, the money changes on. No, that's okay, because Fletcher doesn't mind that. I mean, you know, he's driving out some people for the good for the others. What? Well, yeah, that might be, but that's not really making an ethical decision. On the cross? Yeah. How about forgiving the thief? Well, you can forgive in this kind of love, you know. How about the anointing at Bethany? Do you remember that story? What happens? A woman comes in and starts anointing Jesus' feet with costly oil. Why would that be wrong? What? It's exclusive love, isn't it? That's kind of exclusive. I mean, what would be a better thing to do with that? Sell it and give it to the poor, right? Yeah, that's an exclusive love, isn't it? A one-to-one. I'll read you what Fletcher has to say about this. Take the story of the anointing of Bethany. The issue is between impetuous, uncalculating, unenlightened sentimental love in the woman's use of the costly ointment and a calculating, enlightened love. The disciples say that love must work in coalition with utilitarian distribution, right? That's what the disciples criticize her for. You ought to take the oil, the ointment, and sell it to the poor, spreading the benefits as much as possible. The Gospel accounts cast Jesus into the role of Leo Tolstoy's doctrine that love wears blinders, seeing only the neighbor there. If we take the story as it stands, Jesus was wrong and the disciples were right. Attempts have been made to excuse Jesus, saying he was trying to comfort the thoughtless but sincere woman, softening the criticism of the bystanders when he actually agreed with them. So maybe he didn't say what he meant. We do not have to conclude that he ever said anything at all like, "You shall always have the poor with you." Okay? Now, I hope you're getting a sense of, you know, if you take Fletcher at his word, I think he's really telling us to be computers. Now, so now we've got two kind of ethics that are sort of congenial with computers. One would be sort of looking at the Bible as a log book. And the other would be having this kind of thing, which is very hard to apply. And so, I don't know, some people say the book was so popular because by the time you're trying to calculate what's the greatest good for the greatest number, you can justify doing anything. And so you can feel good about whatever you want to do anyway, which is sort of the opposite of Lutherans who like to feel guilty about whatever they do. But, you know, this is sort of a, Lutherans maybe have a no win. They have a no, Fletcher has a no lose. But both of these are kind of computer mentalities, just different forms of working. Now, I think that's happening in ethics a lot, or in popular ethics. And I think this happens today. Let's apply Fletcher, where I see that kind of reasoning. Have you ever heard of the lifeboat ethics? The lifeboat ethics is there anybody that doesn't know what it is? Okay. That is, the world is, we're all sort of individual countries. And there aren't very many, enough resources to go around in terms of, you know, we each have our lifeboat with various resources. And some countries are rich and some countries are poor. And if we let the poor countries onto our lifeboat, they'll sink. Therefore, we should let certain countries who are overpopulated and can't produce enough food just starve. Now that's the kind of reasoning that comes when you detach all emotion and empathy from things, right? It's very nice because it's unambiguous. You know what you have to do. Because you divorce yourself from all feelings. Because if we identified, at least, I don't know, again, I don't know, I think maybe the women here would agree with me, perhaps the men. I can't think of anything more obscene than a woman trying to feed a baby and she can't because she's too malnourished to manufacture milk. You know, and when I think that way and feel that way, then this lifeboat ethic doesn't make any sense. But if I could divorce myself from my emotions, you know, it gets to be kind of a nice little game, right? We can calculate which countries have to starve and which countries not, and we can feed it into his computer and you can program us, right? I think we want to think this way because we don't want to deal with ambiguity. If ever we allow our feelings into a situation, they're ambiguous, right? Have you ever had any times when you've tried to sort out your feelings about something and totally failed? Huh? You know how ambiguous feelings are, aren't they? Do I love that guy or hate him? Sometimes I can't decide, right? Are you mad or happy? Do you care about or... You know, feelings are very ambiguous. They're hard to sort out. I think, despite all the stuff we want to say about not having a computer as a model, and we want to be different, I think we often fall into that. Because we value the kind of thinking that computers can do. And we distrust our own feelings of empathy, emotion, and see them as sort of second rate. And I think you get this a lot in terms of ethics, just in one particular way. If you don't have those kind of clear, ambiguous, unambiguous instructions, some people either have that or complete relativism. They'll take nothing in between. Relativism's pretty big nowadays, right? Most people don't want to buy it completely, but it's sort of, you know, there's no way of really deciding between ethical values. One culture will raise you one way, one culture will raise you another, and in this culture that makes sense, in that culture this makes sense. And if Dave and I disagree on something on ethics, we really can't decide, because we can't prove it in a way that would be logically consistent with the computer. And so if we don't have something like Fletcher's nice calculation or a law book that we can look up, perhaps then we end up in relativism. And I'll just close with one example and then try to figure out how we might get an ethic that would be less computer-like, and there are examples around. In dealing with abortion, I sometimes use this little article. I'm going to mispronounce it. Cecily Bach. And she lists seven things that one ought to consider, when trying to decide whether or not to have an abortion. Seven factors. But she doesn't tell us how to weigh them. She doesn't say which one should be most important. You know, somehow, you know, they're like, how am I going to make these decisions? Well, you got to do these seven things and somehow balance them, and one might be more important in one situation and one might be more important in the other. And my students get horribly frustrated. You know, I give them a case and I said, what factors would you look at? They get horribly frustrated because they want to know which one is a decisive one. Which is the right answer? They seem to think they have to be able to come up with a right answer, at least the way she would come up with it. And I can't get them to say, well, there might be a different way that you would apply these. Now, let me just read them to you, and I think you'll get a sense of how you could apply them differently. She asked the time of pregnancy, the earlier the better. Whether the pregnancy was voluntarily undertaken, less responsibility for rape than if I intended to get pregnant. Of the importance and validity of the reasons for having an abortion. It might be something like, to save my life would be more important than to preserve my career, but to preserve my career would be more important than to be able to go mountain climbing at Holden Village when I'm here. The technique that's used, whether the father agrees to the abortion, and that will vary with time, right? If the father is will take no responsibility for a child, his opinion isn't as important as if he will take responsibility for the child, raising the child. Whether alternatives have been considered. The woman's own values. Now notice, those things don't balance very well. We couldn't program a computer to make this decision without giving precise weights to it, which is something she refuses to do. And that kind of ambiguity just sort of immobilizes my students. They say, it's a bad article. Let's get something that tells me precisely what to do. And if you can't do that, well, then maybe ethics has nothing to say. Let's see if Dave has a response and then throw it open on terms of...
Yeah. First, I'll respond to some of the things that said on Fletcher. I guess about the only thing I would agree with from Fletcher.
Yeah. I don't agree with Fletcher. Yeah.
Would love is not a feeling. I don't think love should be considered a feeling. I think feelings should be considered perceptions, the same way sight, touch, same way they are, and they perceive realities. And the same way I look at that and I see an object out there, the same way feelings and emotions perceive realities, which we call trust and love. And these realities are at least as real as objects. They're really real. Okay. Now, you're right that they have a lot of ambiguity, and of course other cultures, well, fine. Who says reality has to be precise and exact? Right? It's just that we're so used to calling, demanding precision that we can't accept feelings as being the same as sight in terms of a perception that we have, because feelings aren't as precise. They don't give us as precise information. So I would say that love should be treated as real. Mysterious, yes. Ambiguous, yes. But nevertheless, just as real as anything that is certainly more real than something like a pencil, an object. From there, I disagree with Fletcher. And he reflects the attitude that goes behind the computer, which says love is will, to be commanded, controlled, and then calculated. Well, this is, of course, what you do with a computer. You can control it. That's what makes a computer so useful. So the word control and use together mean power. Okay, and it's a powerful instrument. And then he says calculations lead to care. was another statement he had. I would reverse that. That care may or may not lead to calculations. Now, so I agree with everything you've said, the criticism of it, and I'm just kind of clarifying this. I do see Fletcher, as you've described him, as trying to get this computer model out there as metaphor of how we should behave. And that's what the session is. You've also pointed out, and I had this written down, that the opponents of Fletcher seem to be doing the same thing. Okay, they take the Bible out of here. Here are the rules. How can you talk about relativism? And you're into one type of computer thinking versus another. The one says you're supposed to calculate. The one says all the rules are there, and you just have to look up the right rules. But a computer, of course, can do both. A computer can have a whole lot of rules, and you say if, go to, or a computer can go ahead and calculate. Okay, once you have the general rules of calculation programmed in. So a computer can do either one of those. So what I'd suggest to you is that both of these, this whole discussion between Fletcher and his opponents, is taking place in a technological milieu, a technological culture, and they are using the language and symbolism and rationality and expectations of this technological culture, the 20th century technological culture, where precision and objectivity and calculation and order and control and efficiency and all of those things are considered important. They are considered important. And I would say that particularly the religious denominations that have their foundings in the 20th century and late 19th century, they're going to have to struggle with that. And these are a lot of the fundamentalist, American fundamentalist religions. They're going to have to struggle at a lot of their thinking that went into their theology is 20th century thinking. I'm not saying that that makes them less than any other denomination, because we all have to struggle with the historical roots under which we were born. Lutherans have to struggle with authoritarian control and so forth and so on, because there was in that culture that we are Luther was born and raised, that was a big thing, and sexism and a whole lot of other things that came out of that. We have to struggle with that. Okay, so the 20th century way of thinking, which is the metaphor is the computer, influences both sides of the argument in terms of Fletcher. Now, if I go back to our experience yesterday, what we did is we went through the computer, and then I pressed you and said, are you just a computer? I mean, all right, we do calculate. I'm not saying let's throw that out. But are you called to be more than a computer? And everybody in their gut feeling said yes. Okay? So our rebellion against the dominance of the computer is kind of existential. We feel it in our being. We must be more than just that. That does not mean that we throw out calculations. That does not mean that we throw out rules. It doesn't mean that at all. It means we are called to be more than that. More than that. And we feel that in the essence of who we are. And that, I said, was a call. A call to be more than just fitting into the computer metaphor. And I think that's kind of where we are now, and I would suggest that the Bible, to a large extent, while I'm not saying that it doesn't have some rules and guidelines and so forth and so on, I say to a large extent the Bible is a series of stories of people who were called to be in their particular culture, and it caused them tremendous problems in their culture, just like it will in ours. And they were called, I guess, mainly to care, to become involved, to make a difference. And I think that's what we all are. We're all called to care. And I said that's the one thing the computer doesn't do very well, is care. The danger, of course, is that in our 20th century, we will transform the word care into something that the computer can do.
Which is what Fletcher does.
Yes, and that's a very easy thing. In fact, that's the demonic side of the computer, okay? Which does not say that the computer is bad. You have to recognize the difference between evil and bad and the demonic. The demonic is always associated with the good. And it's where a vehicle to goodness becomes overextended until it becomes the substitute, the constraint, or the dominant metaphor for goodness itself. And that's the demonic. Okay, so that's kind of my response, anyhow. So if you want to respond to my response, go ahead.
Well, I agree with your response. I think we should open it up, and maybe the way to go would be, I will give one response in defense of ethicists. I don't want to imply that there are two ethicists in the world, one Joseph Fletcher and one somebody that would take the Bible as a law code. Obviously there are other people that would try much more not to fall into this computer as metaphor kind of thinking. So
the dominance of that. Now both Fletcher and the other side, the opponents of Fletcher, have something to say. Mm-hmm. We do need some rules. Mm-hmm. And they're usually rules that, but they're not the end. I mean, God calls us even beyond the rules. Certainly the story of Abraham sacrificing his son, if that doesn't tell us that. That's a frightening story about being called beyond anything that we would normally expect.
But I selected these two primarily to try to say that this metaphor might be influencing us when we don't realize it.
That's right.
And I think that the popularity of this kind of ethic, the kind of cold-blooded calculating, triage sorting, it's very popular in some circles today. And so let's maybe take David's question and push a little bit and say, what would it mean in terms of rules or anything else? And saying, well, we don't want to deny our emotions, but we don't want to become completely irrational. How do we live today without using a computer as a metaphor?
Well, maybe just go back to what you started a little bit on Eros, Philippi, and agape love. As I sort of thought about it from listening to your comments, I'd always had the feeling that agape love, let's say in a marriage or in a friendship, it had components of friendship, had components of Eros, but as you moved to agape love, either in community or marriage or parenthood, there was more a will element. So if you woke up in the morning and hated the world, you still would will to love your children or your spouse. But I get more of a negative feeling about will as you compare it in contrast with the computer. And I would see that in our Christian community, we would need more will than agape rather than more emotion. And by this I mean, there probably isn't a person who hasn't seen a picture of a starving child and felt great emotion. But we haven't put enough will into that to do something for that starving child. So I've always had, I want more computer in agape the way you're saying it. I always thought we needed more will to do.
Yeah, I'm kind of wondering, though, in terms of, just in terms of responding to you. I see the starving child, but I don't let it touch me much. I happen to live alone. So for the longest time, I had dinner with Walter every night. Walter Cronkite, yeah. He and I always had dinner together. It was very nice. Dan isn't quite as nice, but Walter I sort of liked. I'm getting used to Dan now. And you know, he'd be showing me all these horrible things on television. There I am eating, and eating away, as you know, quite really divorced from it. And I remember one time I saw pictures of children in Vietnam who had been napalmed, and their faces had melted and run. You saw those pictures, you know, the napalm just melts the face into the thing. And I was watching them okay, and all of a sudden I started imposing pictures of children I knew and children I loved. So I was no longer seeing strangers. And I started, I had to, you know, talk about being overcome by emotion. You know, I almost ran out of the room. I went kind of like this so I wouldn't have to see anymore. And so I'm not really sure the part of it isn't that we've got very good at insulating ourselves from the pain, so that we don't really respond with will, yeah.
I don't mean to say that will or calculations or rules or technology is bad. I really don't want to say that. I would say that we tend to make those things the fundamental character of who we are, the computer as the dominant metaphor of who we are. And what I'm saying is we're called to be more than that, and I use the word care. We really care. And then because we care, well, then
you know, some of the things we have to do involve willpower. That's true. Mm-hmm. Because we care. It's not the other way around. Okay? And I think that Fletcher seemed to switch it around a little bit. And once you put power and control and I think what he said, calculation before care, then what is the basis of the power? If power becomes the value in itself, power to impose rules, power to impose ethics, ethical standards, power to do whatever it is, then what is the basis of saying that something really matters? Okay, that's called nihilism. And where power takes the primary and then care is supposed to come out of that the way power says it should. What I'm saying is what we need is care is kind of the fundamental way that we approach our world, or it's more fundamental. And that is something a computer generally does not do. And so we have to struggle with being dominated by the computer metaphor. That's what I'm saying.
James Nelson, in a book, Embodiment, that's in the bookstore, has kind of an interesting way of doing this, where he talks about sexuality, which be my way of being male or female in the world, is God's ingenious way of calling us into communion with others. And so that includes, you know, all my emotions and my feelings and my need to be touched and to touch. And this is God's ingenious way of eliciting care in us, so that we would then follow through in terms of what you're talking about. Yes?
I don't know whether it brings up or not, but I, as a lot of you know, I draw a weekly cartoon. That's editorial cartoon. So I'm trying to always be papers and try to analyze. And I'm not a student of all these things at all, but I operate sort of gut feelings and react to them in a cartoon. And that's usually a caricature. And I have to simplify a subject. And Dave's on when I showed these cartoons, he saw the one I'm going to talk about. And while we're in a small group like this, I might bring it up. Because it kind of illustrates this thing, as far as I'm concerned, trying to analyze and trying to come to grips with. But I was very much disturbed when the administration came in. Human rights thing was sort of dropped and kind of and so on. And a new kind of a philosophy was entering in, where it has to be to our own material good or something like that to perform some act of good in the world, as far as our political thing is concerned. And so I drew this little cartoon, a little child, addressing President Reagan at a podium. And the little child says, "Mr. President, how do you spell ethics?" And he looks down in big letters. He says, "Why, ethics. Could I put a line through the S?"
Sign.
He says, "Of course." Now, I don't know whether that...
I think that's the trap that people fall into. Mm-hmm.
Because the one side is the emotion side. The other is I have to measure the value of performing an act of ethics.
Yeah, right.
Of course, then, beyond the dollar sign is the welfare of those whose income is eroding because of inflation. And that's the thing, that we're beyond the computer. We can see these things. Our perception is more than just a limited series of programs or assumptions or inputs. The consciousness is of a broader scope than just a limited kind of thing.
Everybody's going to have more money, you know, real money. I mean, we would say, you know, I think that would be the goal of the whole thing. And I think maybe what we need to do is say, is that the goal of the whole thing? So I'm agreeing with you, but I'm saying we got to dig even deeper than that. I mean, they could end up having a very successful program to control inflation, and everybody's wealthier in terms of dollars. But is that what it's really about? And that is a hard question to deal with.
You tied several things together there. Money is one factor of pressure we have in our society. Time, as you were talking about the other day, is another one. You know, the computer business. It gets to a point, like you were talking about Walter Cronkite, where we're on overload. And I think it's good for us to be reminded that we have to care. Because sometimes when you're on overload, it's so easy to go by the computer. In fact, there are times when that's what gets you through.
More efficient.
But there, that balance is just amazing.
Yes, and I would agree with what Dave said. I am not against all calculation or against all the rules and principles or anything like that. I just think they become the determinant of things. Yes.
I have one, I guess, a question of Dave, or rather a point of clarification, because I don't think I think I'd like to have him clarify a little his definition of feelings being real, which, you know, I totally agree with, but I thought I heard him say something like real in the sense of an object. You know, an object can be quantified and computerized.
I'm saying feeling, I like to think of feelings as perceptions, the way I think of senses, the way I think of sight, the way I think of touch. Now, in our world, sight and touch are considered, particularly sight, is the most primary sense. And that's because you can divide things up in sight. You can't smell very well, and you certainly can't feel it. If there's a herd of horses in sight, I can count them. I can be very precise. How I feel about a herd of horses, though, I can't be very, very precise about it. So, but I would say that the way I'm looking at it now, and I don't know whether this is my final answer on this, of course I can say about anything, that emotions are perceptions. In the same way sight and sound is. We have more than five senses. We have far more. I mean, there are infinite senses. It's just that when we get into the emotions and feelings, if we can't distinguish them that well.
That's the point.
Okay, we can't. But that's okay, because who says the world is supposed to be broken up into nice, precise pieces? We say that. But does that mean that the world has to do it because we said so? So, now, what I say is when we see and touch objects. So when we evaluate sight and touch as being the most important senses, our world becomes a world of objects, because that's what you see and touch. Okay. Now, if we're willing to accept that feelings and emotions are also senses, perceptions, the same way sight and touch is, then we have to start treating love as a real thing, not simply as a feeling. I don't want to equate love with a feeling. I want to say the feelings perceive something that is very real as or more real than any object, okay? And it's very real. Trust is real. Care is real. All of those things are really real. Forgiveness is a real action, the same as hammering a nail. I'm not saying, but I mean, it's just as real. It's not something that's kind of, well, your inward feeling. You see, what we tend to do is we tend to equate love and trust with the feelings, the perceptions of them, and that makes them illusionary. Okay, that makes them illusionary.
All right.
Okay.
I was just trying to bring up the difference between real in terms of the perceptions we can measure can be quantified and computerized.
That's right.
That, you know, the real feelings that are being real defy that. Yes.
Yeah, and that's where we tend, because of our mentality nowadays, to really think
that something is not
real. Yeah, it's not real.
Right.
Or it's unimportant, or it's even embarrassing.
That's right.
I mean, even I get embarrassed about feelings, and I'm a woman, so I've been conditioned to be freer about expressing feelings.
And the irony of it is it's true that emotions are not inseparable and precise, and you can be confused over them, but that is all the more reason to share them in community, so that one can sort out the reality that's there by helping each other. The scientists know this in terms of sight and touch and measurement, that they have to work within a community because it's easy for one individual to be fooled, okay? But when it comes to the emotions, what we feel as opposed to what we see, we say, well, they're vague, so we don't share them. And yet that's what ought to be shared, because they are sometimes vague, and we need to check out from each other, and we need to share in a community. So we're going the opposite way. Maybe it's not as important to share what you can see and measure, because that's pretty precise. That's pretty exact.
I'm not so sure it's precise.
That's true. I'll agree with that.
probably wouldn't be able to see them. We don't have no one on the top of the table. And we're all alone up there. There's a forest through the field. First of the engine, and up to the house, and if I worked for the forest through, and in my busy street, and I walk in the office, I get some of my old friends. The things have all changed. In order for them to make a decision, they have to go through the computer program to Fort Collins, or wherever it might be, and assemble all these facts and so on, and then sit around, drink their coffee, and try to make, have the computer make a decision for them. We just threw up that I'm throwing up the trail today, 56, because we've got a volunteer group and holding him on the top of the trail. I can't think of them. Maybe I'll go to Washington, I'll go to Fort Collins. You know what we got the last year? How much runoff and so on, they could probably compete.
Yeah, we're sitting here not without her walking up there.
Move the boulder quickly. To the point of absurdity, though.
I don't mean to say that computers are not useful to me, but in my own case, when I did my doctoral work in computer models, I've kind of gotten away from that. I've left the use of computers somewhat because I've been somewhat disappointed in what they really can do, what they really can do, not what the papers say they can do, and the manuals say they can do, and the administrators say they can do. There's one story I'll just tell you. Sea Grant meeting. Sea Grant is a part of the university. And the director was up there holding up this computer modeling and saying, wow, this thing can do, and he's telling all that it can do, and I just, the more he would talk, it was in my area of research, I just kind of slumped down in my chair, felt like I was all behind. You know, I just couldn't feel, wow, this is, you know, all my research is years behind. Here this guy had this computer program, and I got up later, went up and said, all right, give me a copy of it. And it was a graduate student of mine, his thesis that they had put in a report, and the modeling was my approach plus some things he had added, and he couldn't do any of that. But he didn't know enough to know that. He didn't know enough about it to know that, and of course, the reports are written up, everything comes up the hierarchy, it's always a little more flowery language that's applied. Well, by the time it got to the top, the people who did it couldn't even recognize what they were saying. And that has happened several times.
All the time.
Yes, you just get out there and you hear this wonderful thing that all these things can do. You just feel like, oh, I'm a total failure. I haven't been able to keep up with this area, you know. And, then you find, and then the administrator leaves maybe, and the people who did the work come in, and then they tell you all the problems and all the... It's really something. So that there is, I don't mean to knock computers, but my own experience has been that I tended to, the more I work in them, place a little less confidence in them because they can be misused terribly. They are powerful, they are very powerful, yes. I mean, I don't mean to knock that. There are some wonderful things they can do. And some of these robots, right? I think, you know, if we're going to get at the truth, the emotions have to be part of what we share.
Yeah, part, but not... Only.
Right.
I think we're having a real difficult time in our society dealing with ambiguity. And I think we have a difficult time because it immobilizes it. Either we say it's too complex, we can't make a decision, or else we take some easy answer and become this is what I believe and don't bother me with any facts. And we need to really learn to deal with ambiguity in a way that we can make a decision so it doesn't immobilize us, but not have to become fanatical about the decision. Say, as in the case of if I'm using chemicals, I might become fanatical in the sense that I don't, no matter what, I don't want to have to admit that I might have hurt future generations, somebody's kid, so I can't listen to any data that might suggest that.
Now, that happens.
Yeah.
That
happens. Yeah. Either
there's some harm connected with everything.
That's right. So we have to... Yeah.
The fact to have harm involved in your body just deteriorates in your profession.
You see, that's where we have to sort of do a lot of weighing, right? But weighing with a sense of caring. Now, I think if we can learn to live with our own emotions better, we will get a greater tolerance toward ambiguity. Because our own emotions are not unambiguous. And I think that's one reason why maybe we're so embarrassed about emotion in our society.
Yes, the emotions are real.
But now to sort out what that means, the
they're not consistent
that.
With one another in a way that.
It's clear that it's always hard to separate constellations and emotions because it's just like getting on an airplane. You know, I've got to calculate the fact that it might not fly, and yet I can't be too emotional about not being on it. So I live a normal life that's going to work out. So I either have to stay there or I have to calculate it with the fly.
It's just like in many cases you don't have precise measurements. You have to make a decision anyway. And so even though it's not, you know, all the measurements are right, you still have to
use your emotions only in this regard.
Oh, yeah, you don't
want to
use your emotions. You can't do it.
It's right now, I think you're right. You don't use your emotions only.
Yeah, perhaps the difficulty we have is some people want to use only emotions, other people want to become computers, and somehow we have to learn to deal with the ambiguity of merging them.
And
because we're the ones who can demonstrate it.
We're schizophrenic is what we are.
Yeah.
That's because we divide the world up into the subjective, which is the emotional and the inward, you're not supposed to talk much about. Objective over here, which is precise and measurable and so forth. Let's just get rid of this object and subjective and start saying, what are we? What are we really experiencing? If we experience the emotions of it, we have to say, well, what does that mean? In the same way, if I have some data up here, people say, well, what does that really mean? Oh, you've seen data up there, it means nothing. Okay, well, that may also be true with emotions. I mean, maybe you're totally mistaken, a person. But that's not a reason to not examine spirit. In fact, just the opposite. It is a reason to share it. If you're sure about it, then maybe it isn't much easier.
So there was an emotional reaction against doing autopsies in the Middle Ages, and probably most of us would say that was wrong because they needed it for the medical care. So that doesn't mean emotions are always right. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.